Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from SIRI, an Alaska Native corporation with operations and investments spanning 5 continents, 45 states, and 2 U.S. territories.
Our subsistence cabins aren't just recreational. They're a means for our food security.
Western Alaskans face the loss of subsistence food, gear, and property. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, September 22nd. Good evening, I'm Casey Grove. Also tonight, Representative Mary Peltola aims to renew the nation's primary fishing law.
Typically, every summer he would harvest 2,000 chum salmon. 2 summers ago, he was only able to harvest 2.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
NEA Alaska is a professional education association representing over 11,000 of Alaska's dedicated public school employees. Their members are united in their commitment to provide an excellent education for every student, regardless of background or zip code. Together, NEA Alaska members work with colleagues, parents, and their communities to build strong public schools that are productive, safe, and welcoming to all. Learn more at neaalaska.org. This message sponsored by NEA Alaska.
Countless numbers of Western Alaskans have lost subsistence resources, food, and even property that ties them to the land. While various agencies are still assessing the scope of damage from last weekend's storm, residents are processing what this loss means to them and their families. KNOM's Davis Hovey reports.
Melanie Banke, CEO of Kowarik Inc., shared with KNOM listeners on Wednesday that the damage to subsistence cabins goes beyond loss of buildings.
We've got several people who have lost their subsistence cabins and their boats, and we all know that our subsistence cabins aren't just recreational. They're a means for our food security, but also our cultural continuation. And they connect us to the land and our ancestors.
Banke's point about the cultural connection being affected by the storm has been echoed again and again by Western Alaskans. Darlene Trigg is one of many Nome residents who no longer has a camp for her and her family to enjoy. It was completely washed away by the storm.
The camp itself is gone, but you look down and you'll see things, right? Like, we had just remodeled it, and there's a doorknob, it was a homemade door, so whatever it is he used to latch it, it's just sitting right there on the ground. We walked over to where the boats were, but you could see his commercial fishing tag on the ground. It was just right there, right where the boat was.
Some locals still have their family cabins intact, but they have been moved across the Safety Sound or relocated to another spot on the tundra. Others are picking through the debris of what used to be their subsistence camps. Trigg highlights the fact that each of her family members have their own story connected to the land where their subsistence cabin used to be. She says even if locals did not lose a cabin, everyone has been impacted because this is a collective experience.
My mom and dad took it upon themselves to make sure that all of the kids had subsistence foods, and it all happened there. My earliest memories are in that building, around that land. It's a part of the foundation of who I am. It's built into my identity.
During his visit to the Norton Sound earlier this week, Governor Mike Dunleavy witnessed the significant damage done to boats and subsistence gear in the Nome area.
You fly up and down this coast, you have countless fish camps, you have countless cabins, you have countless areas where there's valuable property folks can't get to.
Throughout the Norton Sound region, residents have talked about the impact this storm had on their subsistence lifestyle. Daisy Lockwood Kachiak, the city administrator in Stebbins, told KNOM her community will not have as much food for winter.
100% of the fish racks and fishing supplies for all our subsistence fishermen are gone.
Kachiak estimated that a quarter of the community did not even get to fish and gather subsistence food this summer, due to the lack of salmon in the region and the essential work that needed to get done in Stebbins. The community is requesting food deliveries from various agencies to help sustain them over the coming days. As families are pulling together to clean up and repair what's left of their generational cabins, Now the question is, will financial assistance from the federal government help rebuild these vitally important subsistence camps and gear? Banky says Kowarik will do its part to make sure those needs are addressed.
We need to be able to convey that these are not just recreational use cabins. These are our means of supporting our families and our communities.
Alaska's congressional delegation has sent a letter to President Joe Biden urging him to approve Governor Dunleavy's request for a major disaster declaration in western Alaska. Reporting in Nome, I'm Davis Havi.
Five families and a total of 22 people are still displaced from their homes in Hooper Bay, a town of about 1,300. Yesterday, members of the Tribal Council and Village Corporation met to try to find a way forward. KYUK's Will McCarthy reports.
Although the vast majority of people who evacuated their houses over the weekend have returned home, some no longer have any home to return to. Many buildings in Hooper Bay were damaged by the high winds and flooding. Some had their doors, windows, or roofs damaged. Others flooded. One house was ripped off its foundation and sent spinning 500 feet away in the floodwaters. 23-year-old Brittany Simon, who was living with her grandparents, said they won't be able to return home anytime soon.
Half of it is collapsed and is sinking a little in the mud. There was a sinkhole that formed from the flood.
Simon evacuated with her grandparents, three siblings, and her son on Friday. 2 days later, they returned to the house to try to gather their valuables, only to find it irreparably damaged.
We went down the next day, and we gathered all the photos and important papers and stuff from the house. When we walked down the hallway, it made us feel dizzy, nauseous, yeah, because it was so slanted.
Simon is now staying at a church down the street from the school, along with the rest of her family and four other families. Simon said she'd like to move into ABCP Regional Housing Authority low-income apartments, but so far, there's no timeline on when displaced families might be able to do that. Hooper Bay leaders are trying to figure out a way to get people out of the church and into their own houses, but they need to find a way to do that without compromising long-term solutions. Not far from the church, a group of community leaders and officials from the housing nonprofit Rural Cab gathered at the Tribal Council building. One of them is William Nanning, the general manager of Sea Lion Corporation, the Hooper Bay Village Corporation. He's wary about putting people into temporary disaster housing. When a fire destroyed homes and displaced residents years ago, Nanning said he felt like the federal temporary housing provided was inadequate.
What federal government did was build structures that were not meant for Arctic and that were very prone to sweating, molding and stuff like that. While the people that had lost homes were using those.
But Nanning also said that when local government tried to get those people out of their temporary homes into permanent homes, that caused them to lose federal funding opportunities that would help pay to build proper homes. He's worried that if displaced families move into apartments, it could actually cause them to become ineligible for some money. Nanning said that if they place families in low-income apartments, they would no longer meet the federal government's definition of displaced.
I wasn't worried about myself.
Back at the church, Loretta Smith, who also lost her house in the storm, just wants to find a permanent solution. She has a four-year-old son, and she says they're being well taken care of, but it's not the same as having your own place.
I just want to be home already.
The Village Corporation sent contractors out around town today to further assess the damage and see if other homes had foundation, roof, or window damage. In Hooper Bay, I'm Will McCarthy.
Governor Mike Dunleavy was in Nome yesterday to assess the storm damage. During his visit to the Norton Sound region, Dunleavy spent time in Golovin, Elim, and briefly touched down in Koyuk. Based on the state of Alaska's assessment, the five communities that were hit the hardest were Golovin, Hooper Bay, Newtok, Nome, and Scammon Bay. The governor was able to visit all of them over the past few days and noted that Golovin's damage stood out to him.
There's a pretty flat spit there as well as a hill where homes are located. That spit got hit pretty hard. We saw a lot of devastation there. A lot of high water, teacher housing, other housing, buildings, connexes that have were blown across the inlet quite some distance, now located on the other side of the inlet.
Weather continues to be a factor in the recovery process for Western Alaska. Dunleavy says there is a limited window of time for recovery as freeze-up is fast approaching.
You got to move fast. We can't let bureaucracy stand in the way because every day is a day for some folks in a wet house, or every day is a day in which their house is off their foundation, or they can't get to where their boats are because the roads are gone.
On Tuesday, Governor Dunleavy sent a request to the federal government asking for financial assistance through grant programs and for 100% federal share in cost. It's unclear if or when President Joe Biden will issue a major disaster declaration to assist Western Alaska. Puerto Rico is also currently asking for help to recover from Hurricane Fiona. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, pushback against transgender student bathroom policies in the Matanuska Susitna Borough Schools.
These kids are a part of your community, whether you like it or not. So please stop trying to make life harder for them.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Everyone knows eating fruits and veggies promotes a long and healthy life. It's important to make every bite count. Alaskans are lucky to have greens and berries from the land, as well as fresh, frozen, and canned. When it comes to living a long and healthy life, remember, every bite counts. This message sponsored by USDA SNAP Ed.
An unfinished goal of the late Congressman Don Young was to renew the Magnuson-Stevens Act, the primary federal fishing law. The U.S. House Natural Resources Committee took up a bill to do that yesterday. Alaska's new Congresswoman Mary Peltola wants it to pass to address the salmon crisis in western Alaska, but she's facing strong headwinds. Alaska Public Media's Liz Ruskin reports.
Peltola wants her colleagues to understand how dire the situation is for families in her home region, where people depend on salmon for food. She told of one Kuskokwim fisherman who usually harvests 2,000 chum salmon a year.
Because he has a dog team and a very large family. So typically, every summer, he would harvest 2,000 chum salmon. Two summers ago, he was only able to harvest 2 chum salmon.
The impact of her anecdote in the hearing room Wednesday was hard to measure. Republicans attended in force to skewer many provisions in the Democratic bill. Some spoke of how important sport fishing is to their families and communities. The bill includes a change Peltola has advocated for, adding 2 seats on the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council for Alaska tribal members. Without those seats at the table, she says, the Fisheries Management Council will always be more receptive to the large trawl fleet. They catch salmon by accident. Peltola says this bycatch contributes to the fish crisis facing coastal communities and those upriver.
After 30 years of industrial fishing in the Bering Sea, where they're tossing out metric tons of juvenile crabs, halibut, and salmon, it catches up with us. And then we get to the point where people who depend on hundreds of salmon to fish their family, to feed their families every year, are not able to even catch single-digit numbers of salmon.
Of course I object to this.
That's Republican Congressman Cliff Bentz of Oregon. His state has 1 seat on the North Pacific Council. Bentz says Alaska already has 6 seats. Alaska Native people could be appointed to them. Peltola counters that Alaska Native fishing experts don't often have the resumes that get political appointments. She says 2 of the most valued voices on Kuskokwim fishing were a retired plumber and a retired electrician.
But both of these gentlemen had spent every single summer of their life on the river. They came from a lineage that had a 12,000-year relationship with their fishing sites. Unbroken, 12,000 summers.
Opponents of the bill also say it would crack down on bycatch to the point that no fishery could survive. The primary author of the bill is Representative Jared Huffman, a California Democrat. He says it merely emphasizes the need to minimize bycatch.
Minimize bycatch to the extent current law says practicable. We would change it to possible, but you're still within the context of acknowledging bycatch will always exist.
The ATSI Processors Association, representing the big players in the Bering Sea pollock fishery, declined an interview request. That industry group and 40 others wrote a letter blasting the bill. If it passes, they warn, the fishing sector will be in chaos. Fisheries will be shut down. The letter says managers and fishermen already go to great lengths to minimize bycatch. Opposition like that has killed prior efforts to pass a Magnuson-Stevens reauthorization. House Resources Chairman Raul Grijalva says he hopes to pass the bill out of committee and get it to the full House soon. Reporting from the U.S. Capitol, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Anchorage's Sullivan Arena may once again become a homeless shelter. During an Assembly Housing and Homelessness Committee meeting yesterday, Assembly members worked through a plan to house roughly 350 homeless people through the winter. A task force released its preliminary plan last week. Among their recommendations was using the former Golden Lion Hotel as well as the Dempsey Ice Arena for sheltering. The committee meeting was packed with people opposed to using the Dempsey Arena. The facility is in close proximity to West High School and Romig Middle School. Shauna Fitzgerald, who said she has a child enrolled at West, expressed concerns over safety.
Please tell me how putting a shelter within feet of two schools is somehow a plan that could even be considered. Not only are these schools occupied literally with thousands of children, the walking paths between these campuses and Dempsey are utilized every single day.
During the meeting, Assembly members reviewed several facilities identified by the task force as sheltering options that could become available by the end of the month when the Centennial Park campground will be closed. That area has been the site of a makeshift homeless camp after the Sullivan Arena Mass Shelter closed in late June. Members ended up selecting the Sullivan as well as the Golden Lion as part of a tentative emergency shelter plan. South Anchorage Assembly member Suzanne LaFrance lauded the compromise.
I just want to point out, not only do we have a plan that doesn't involve taking any facilities that impact youth hockey.
Thank you.
The Assembly is set to vote on appropriating funds for its emergency shelter plan during a special meeting Monday night. The exact dollar figure is pending. Residents of the Matanuska-Susitna Borough continue to weigh in on the school board's bathroom policy for transgender students. At last night's meeting, opponents argued that the district's new policy is discriminatory. Alaska Public Media's Katie Anastas reports.
Earlier this month, the MATSU school board voted to suspend a policy that allowed transgender students to use bathrooms and locker rooms that match their gender identity. At that meeting, more than two dozen people spoke in favor of suspending the policy. The only community member to speak against it then was the board's student representative, Vanessa Shackle. She said it was important to consider the perspective of students and staff, not just parents. And she said students felt like verifying someone's gender assigned at birth was an invasion of privacy.
Students' use of the bathroom has become an over-sexualized conversation amongst persons outside of school.
Wednesday's meeting drew additional opponents of the change. Miles McDonald is transgender and a former student in the district. McDonald said bathroom policies like these add to the stress that queer and trans kids already face.
These kids are a part of your community, whether you like it or not. So please stop trying to make life harder for them. Growing up queer is already one of the hardest parts of youth to come to terms to, when you feel that you aren't accepted by anyone else and it's constantly proven to you.
Jessica Young told the board it could threaten the economic future of the area.
Kids will go to college and never come back to the MATSU because they will understand that they are accepted other places. Kids will move out deliberately. Young educated people will move out deliberately. Businesses will decide not to come here because of discriminatory policies.
Young also mentioned that September is National Suicide Prevention Month.
And that the single biggest indicator of whether or not a trans child will attempt or complete suicide is how affirming their parents, school, and friends are.
Others spoke in favor of the September 7th decision. Ron Johnson has three great-grandchildren in the district, and he said the board's decision had broad support.
MATSU supports this. I mean, it's pretty obvious. I've been coming to the last three school board meetings. This reflects the values of our community.
The board's vote earlier this month temporarily suspended the policy allowing students to use bathrooms matching their gender identity. But the school board could be required to reinstate that policy if the Federal Department of Education finalizes changes to Title IX it proposed in June. Wednesday's meeting also included a vote on whether teachers should be required to set aside between 1 and 2 minutes each morning for a moment of silence. According to the policy, a teacher, quote, may not make suggestions as to the nature of any reflection that a student may engage in during the moment of silence, unquote. In 1985, the Supreme Court struck down an Alabama state statute because it established a moment of silence for, quote, meditation or voluntary prayer, unquote. The Mat-Su School Board's policy does not mention prayer or meditation, but it instructs teachers to, quote, encourage parents or guardians to discuss with their children how to best use the moment of silence, unquote. It passed 5-1, with board member Dwight Probasco voting no. Probasco said he thought the policy should give teachers the option to set aside a moment of silence rather than mandate it. In Anchorage, I'm Katie Anastas.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
If you are a hunter, birder, or outdoor enthusiast, the U.S. Geological Survey is asking for help tracking the bird populations in Alaska. The USGS manages a nationwide bird banding program, and every year, thousands of birds are marked with small, numbered leg bands. If you see, find, or harvest a banded bird, please report the band number online at reportband.gov. The information provided will help inform how bird populations may be changing. This message sponsored by the USGS Alaska Science Center.
The Bureau of Land Management has begun a 45-day scoping period for a supplemental environmental review of the proposed Ambler Road. KUAC's Dan Bross reports.
The additional Ambler Road analysis was ordered by a U.S. District Court judge in May following lawsuits filed by environmental and Alaska Native groups to stop the road and a request by the Biden administration to address deficiencies identified in the original EIS conducted during the Trump administration. BLM Alaska Acting Communications Director Jason Barangin says the supplemental review will focus on two primary issues.
Related to Alaska Native Tribal consultation for assessing, you know, potential impacts to traditional properties, as well as, you know, deficiencies in terms of impacts related to subsistence resources.
Barangin says additional topics may also be considered based on input received during the scoping period.
From the public, from the Alaska Native tribes, from the Native corporations, as well as other folks that are interested in the project will help inform what resources, what topics, what concerns should be looked at in the analysis.
In July 2020, the Trump administration issued federal right-of-way permits to the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority for the 211-mile road from the Dalton Highway west along the southern foothills of the Brooks Range to the Ambler Mining District. The federal government suspended those permits this past February in light of the EIS deficiencies. Barangin says the supplemental review will be the basis for another decision on the road.
We want to be inclusive. We want to hear what folks have to say. And we want to come to a durable decision that will help ensure resilient landscapes in that part of the state.
Barangin says the National Environmental Policy Act allows up to 2 years to complete the supplemental EIS process. The scoping period is the first step and closes November 4th. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Mountain View Elementary School in Kenai does not have its own full-time art teacher. But that isn't stopping the school from spending an entire week on art with help from a special guest. KDLL Sabine Pooks has more.
Look too closely at the paper hexagons Kenzie Shepherd's gluing down onto white paper, and you'll see a disparate collage of multicolored shapes. But zoom out a bit, and the picture sort of crystallizes.
I am making like a kind of sunset that like takes into purple, like those kind of sunsets that go into purple kind of.
Shepherd is a fourth grader at Mountain View Elementary School in Kenai. This Wednesday morning, it's her class's turn to work with Jay Leslie while he's in town for a week-long artist residency at the elementary school. And hexagons are kind of his thing. The Seward artist creates geometric mountains and ocean landscapes, collaged from six-sided tiles in bright hues of blue and purple, yellow and pink. And as he explains to the fourth graders, he likes hexagons because they fit together nicely, like the pieces of a puzzle.
They make this super special kind of pattern called the tessellation. And that's what we're going to be talking a fair deal about today. So let's just practice, listen to that word, like close your eyes and just listen to this word. Starts with a T, tessellation, and then let's all say it together. tessellation.
The classroom is a familiar space for Leslie. Before he was full-time, he was an elementary school teacher in Kenai and Seward. These days, he mostly works alone to create vibrant wall art and murals from his Seward studio.
Being an artist is inherently kind of a pretty isolated existence. And so that, from a selfish perspective, like, I get a lot out of teaching because it's like actually getting out in the world and interacting with kids and other people.
He says art classes were important to him when he was a student, as his artistic confidence grew.
I actually remember I grew up in rural New Hampshire, and we did not have an art teacher in our school building either, but a couple times had, like what I'm doing right now, an artist in residence come to school, and I still very vividly remember the art that I made with that. I think my mom still has it hanging up, like in her house somewhere.
Leslie says abstract art in particular can help kids get creative. He encourages students not to think too hard about the end product while they're working.
I feel like that kind of just opens up and sort of gets kids out of this loop of things needing to look a certain way and being afraid of making mistakes, and they're kind of willing to just explore.
Mountain View Elementary principal Carl Kircher says he's excited about the chance to bring more art into the classroom.
It, you know, draws on a different part of their brain. You know, you can go out to recess and you come back charged for your next class, and you can go do art and come back charged for your next class too.
Mountain View doesn't have a dedicated art teacher now, but Kircher says teachers incorporate art into their classrooms as much as possible.
Art, you know, has to be part and parcel to what you do, you know, as an elementary teacher. Then it's up to me as a building leader, if we don't have the funding, to search out those other sources.
He says this residency was funded by a grant from the Hillcorp Alaska Community Foundation and the Alaska State Council for the Arts. Leslie will work this week with all 400 or so students in the K-5 school, showing them how he puts together his pieces and encouraging them to try their own finished works.
You know, it's really nice to have an end product that's a pretty picture. But to me, that's kind of just like a bonus. Like, it's mostly about the process of it. And I think most kids, while they're making art, are really good at just getting absorbed in that process.
That's true for fourth grader Alexander Shockley, who's letting himself get really caught up in the artistic process.
I'm kind of going for like a pyramid. I just started placing blocks, and then now I'm just going for like a pyramid here.
Some of the other fourth graders at his table are pasting their shapes into flowers and sunsets. Shockley glues down a dozen yellow, orange, and purple hexagons onto paper and shrugs.
I like how I can just kind of be myself and express myself. Kind of just do what I want. You know, kind of create art.
Shockley and the other fourth graders will be back in Leslie's classroom Friday, when they'll get to try their hand at drawing their own geometric pieces. In Kenai, I'm Sabine Pooks.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Davis Hovey in Nome, Will McCarthy in Hooper Bay, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Wesley Early in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Sabine Pooks in Kenai. If you want to send us a news tip, question, or comment, email us at news@alaskapublic.org. Our audio engineer is Dave Emmert, Katie Anastas is our producer, and I'm Casey Grove. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. Public media is designed for and made possible by the communities it serves. Monies generated through estate and deferred gifts enable public radio to provide our listeners, you, with the level of programming excellence you've come to expect. It may also reduce income and estate taxes. Consult your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.